So as it relates to Greenland, that's the rise of China plus the melting of the planet, basically the Arctic. And what's happening when you look at missiles, we think of the globe this way. Missiles don't just go around the globe to hit each other. If Russia or China wanted to shoot a missile at us, it wouldn't go like that. It goes from up here across. It's the fastest way to get to the United States. So what you see happening as the ice melts up there, what you see happening is that Russia has building military facilities, and they've become a junior partner of China, who's piggybacking some of these military facilities. So they're building these facilities up there, and our fear is, and it's happening, is that those two countries are going to build nuclear capacity for launching nuclear ICBMs at us from up there. Now, if they are able to strike us from that proximity, they will get first strike advantage. The whole premise of nuclear weapons has been mutually assured destruction. You hit me in the 17 minutes, I hit you in 17 minutes. Nobody has an advantage. But if you move the weapons to the top, to the North Pole, all of a sudden you cut that in half. Now you can hit me in 7 minutes. So you could actually have, you actually have first strike advantage, which is not an acceptable situation. We can't live in a world where there's a proverbial gun at our head. It's in our self-interest. And imagine a world where our allies are all tilted that way. All capital will flow to China. All tech will flow there. All investment will flow there. I mean, America would be 30, 40% poorer in 10 years if that happened.
Welcome back, everyone. It's just Steve Yang here with Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine stories that matter. And there's been a lot happening in the global markets right now. So I brought someone I respect for a sharp take on how world events translate to real opportunities. Dylan Jovinet, founder and chief analyst of Behind the Markets. How are you, Dylan?
I am good. Thank you for having me. I'm here. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Yeah, Dylan, I'm actually a subscriber to multiple of your services, Behind the Markets. I've benefited. Love to talk to you a little bit about that. But really, you've made a name for yourself, spotting the trends, finding the opportunities. How do you tune out the noise and stay level-headed, amid the headlines? I mean, there's a lot of fodder out there. So if you can kind of help us understand how you figure what matters and what doesn't.
Well, that's a great question. You see these gray hairs? That's what happened when I didn't tune out the noise. You get a little bit, I've been doing this for 35 years now, and you get to see, and I'm a bit, I study history, I study human nature. I understand how humans act in many different scenarios. I understand the history of the financial markets. And I think that I got into history because, psychology will tell you how people might behave. Philosophy will tell you how they should behave, but history tells you how humans have behaved for 6,000 years. So, it's like a secret superpower. When you study history, you can see, how humans behave, and, humans do human things. And that means in the stock market, they chase greed, they run from fear, and humans get euphoric sometimes. We have a capacity to get a very overexcited. Sometimes we get really depressed. So what I try to do is I try to ignore the ups and downs of that. And I go back to first principles. I learned this from Warren Buffett. Do I understand the business? Am I comfortable with management? What is the business worth? And what do I have to pay for that business? And I really just focus on those four questions. And that really guides me in any area that I want. That's helped me shut, helps me shut out the noise.
Dylan, I want to talk to you about some stuff that's been going on. I mean, Greenland's been in the news for a while, strategic importance, resource potential, defense, geopolitics, have you. How do you see all this unfolding? And what do you think is, is actually, who do you think is actually positioned to benefit and gain from all these developments here?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, you can't talk about Greenland or Argentina. Or Venezuela, sorry, without talking about the rise of China. So, the very rise of China is putting pressure on a bunch of different entities in the country. For example, you know, we were very going gung-ho with green, right? Green technology, green this. What we realized is that China has such a competitive advantage in costs, in scale, in manufacturing green cars, that our comparative advantage, we already built in the infrastructure for oil. So the powers that be in this country have decided that we have to, we can't, it would cost us trillions and trillions of dollars just to get to where China is today with green technology. So we have a comparative built-in multi-trillion dollar advantage with oil. So the rise of China is putting pressure in a lot of areas on the system. So as it relates to Greenland, that's the rise of China plus the melting, you know, of the planet, you know, basically the Arctic. And what's happening when you look at missiles, you know, we think of the globe this way. Missiles don't just go around the globe to hit each other. If Russia or China wanted to shoot a missile at us, it wouldn't go like that. It goes from up here across, the fastest way to get to the United States. So what you see happening as the ice melts up there, what you see happening is that Russia has building military facilities, and they've become a junior partner of China, who's piggybacking some of these military facilities. So they're building these facilities up there. And our fear is, and it's happening, is that those two countries are going to build nuclear capacity for launching nuclear ICBMs at us from up there. Now, if they are able to strike us from that proximity, they will get first strike advantage. You know, the whole premise of nuclear weapons has been mutually assured destruction. You hit me in 17 minutes, I hit you in 17 minutes. Nobody has an advantage. But if you move the weapons to the top, to the North Pole, all of a sudden you cut that in half. Now you can hit me in 7 minutes. So you can actually, you actually have first strike advantage, which is not an acceptable situation. We can't live in a world where there's a proverbial gun at our head. It's just not, it's not gonna happen. So Greenland is very, very important for that. Climate change in China, Russia has, you know, China backing them on this, and is piggybacking that Arctic expansion. If you look at the reports on this for the past 10 years.
So how much of U.S. interest in Greenland is tied to natural resources like rare earths, or is it primarily about military defense here?
Rare earths is a funny word. There's nothing rare about them. It's the processing that's rare.
Okay.
So, you know, so the processing of those things is what is really rare. You know, I mean, you know, so I don't know that Greenland. So I think it's a national security issue in Greenland. I think there are other places that have rare earths. But, you know, I mean, you're going to build, you're going to dig under the ice. I mean, we have more access to some here, and on the, there are other places where you can get them. You know, you don't need to start a, you know, conflict with our NATO allies for rare earths. That just, the juice ain't worth the squeeze. You know, I think it's more about, you can get them in Ukraine. You got to deal with Ukraine tomorrow. Like, you can get them in Venezuela. You can get them in South America. You can get them here in the United States. Like, you get them in Australia. You can get rare earths. I mean, we don't have the processing for them. That's a whole different story. But so that, to me, Greenland's national security. And if you actually pull the camera back even further, 2 years ago, Russia launched what we believe was a nuclear, some kind of weapon into space that can actually take out a bunch of our satellites at once. So, you know, a lot of this, it was a very big uproar in Capitol Hill. This congressman, I forget his name, and I don't even want to say it out loud, but he basically had a panic attack on national TV about this. So there's jockeying going on behind the scenes here. You know, for example, Elon Musk just lowered 4,400 Starlink satellites, started the process of that, which is defensive in nature. It's a defensive move. So there's a lot of, there's a chess match happening behind the scenes. I think Greenland is part of that.
So you mentioned Venezuela as well. How does that fit in with the chess match with, and how's China kind of on the forefront of that?
Well, you know, I read a lot of foreign affairs and intelligence journals, and I know a lot of people in that business. And, you know, it's been understood for a while that China was moving military assets into Venezuela. I mean, this is a propped up government. You know, this is the government that's been propped up by Russia and China. Now, if China is going to loan you a gazillion dollars, you know, what do they want in return for that? They want to make sure that if there's trouble in the Taiwan Strait, that they can keep us occupied by either attacking us from Venezuela or launching things from Venezuela, just causing us all types of trouble. So really, this is kind of a guard your flank move. And, you have this tin pot dictator. You can't let you, we're not going to live in a world where our freedom of action is going to be moved because this, this guy is, Venezuela has access to our baggage train. So, again, this is the situation where the reports, both off the record and, in the press, off the record, unnamed sources and through people I know, is that this is about military assets. China was wisely moving into Venezuela, because if I were China, I'd be doing that too. If there's a conflict over Taiwan, China wants to keep us busy in our own hemisphere. We'd have to fight a kind of a two-front scenario. There was also some words that, and I don't know if I believe this, and I haven't heard it confirmed, but there's also been some words, and for a while now, for about 10 years, the sleeper agents, that's kind of, a lot of cranks on the right talk about that. But I've often wondered, given how intense ICE has been, I often wonder if there have been more, more trouble coming up, because again, if we were to fight China, God forbid, because there really wouldn't be any winners. They're just survivors, just degrees of losing. But if we were to fight China in the Taiwan Strait, if I were China, I would have assets planted in South America as close as I can to America. I'd also have sent people up to cause havoc in cities, to hack infrastructure, to do sophisticated things. So, why wouldn't you? Just kind of 101. It's called war. We do what we do in warfare. So just like I'm sure we plant people in their societies, in their countries. So all of a sudden we have a spy that lives, 2 miles away from critical infrastructure over there that can cut off their electric grid or whatever it is, long-term operations. Of course they have them here. Come on, that's the game. It's a power competition.
So you think Venezuela has a lot to do with basically preventing a Venezuela missile crisis sort of thing?
Yeah, I do. I think, well, also, Venezuela has natural resources. Friends of mine say, well, we went in there for the oil. I said, that's true and it's not true. China wouldn't have propped up Venezuela in the first place if it wasn't for oil. Russia wouldn't have propped up Venezuela in the first place if it wasn't for oil. So the reason that everyone's dancing with this otherwise ugly human being is oil. That's the reason we're all there, in the first place. So that's why they're there. And again, if you're China and you're loaning them, $100 billion, they can't pay you back. It's like getting in bed with the mob. They're going to want something else in return. Well, what can you give us in return? Well, let us build this, and this here secretly. Of course, that's happening. How could it not be?
So the headlines have basically moved from political drama to sanctions relief and energy production. I've had people on here saying, how much oil is there really? You've got a huge oil reserve, but the output hasn't been there. And I guess is the oil talk a real? How much oil is in play here? Is that just?
Oh, the oil. Action? This is huge oil, but you're not going to see any action for 5 or 10 years because their infrastructure. We talked about rare earth. There's plenty of rare earth. You just can't process it. Rare processing. Yeah. You have plenty of oil there. You just can't move it. Their infrastructure is in the toilet. So it's going to take a long time. And if you're Chevron or Texas, any of these companies, you say to yourself, well, what am I going to do? Invest $20 billion in this? And the next administration comes in and says, nope, that's it. Not going to do it. So, it's they're in kind of a difficult situation, but there's a ton of oil. My goodness, Venezuela is, I think, the largest proven oil reserves, heavy crude, in the world. Now, of course, that takes a lot of processing, but, it's massive. It's massive. It's insane.
So, it's striking to me just how many allies we've been pissing off. What's the reason behind that? Was that?
It is striking.
Yeah. You need friends. So
yeah.
What's with the, what's behind that?
I don't know. The Sun Tzu quote comes to mind. If an enemy has a lot of alliances, the problem is grave and his position is strong. If an enemy has no alliances, the problem is not grave. The enemy's position is weak. So alliances are super important. I mean, come on, you know.
Yeah.
You know, for years, friends of mine in the national security establishment and I have understood that Europe was going to have to handle Russia. China is too much, too big. You can't, it was military doctrine in the United States in the Cold War to be able to fight a two-front war, two major powers at one time. You know, think of Germany and Japan. China presents real trouble with that. They're just too big, too strong, too powerful, full peer competitor. So this is one of those, we have to focus everything in that direction. We cannot handle Russia and China. So I think the core assumption here is that Europe has to handle Russia. The United States has to handle China. And, I can never justify how the president talks to other leaders or what he says about them at speeches. I find it abhorrent. I really do. I also think it's necessary for Europe to understand that they have to, you know, if we're partners, they've got to fight the enemy on this side. We've got to fight the enemy on this side. You know, I mean, we have to. There will be a conflict over the South China Sea. I mean, there's too much trading, too much money goes to there. And the other thing I think is, you know, again, the way Trump does it, I don't agree with. I don't think we talk to people like that. You do it in private. You don't do it in public. The other thing is, when you look at the United States, our GDP has doubled in the last 20 years, where their GDP has stayed the same in Europe. So, you know, I say to myself, Europe is really slowing, and all that GDP growth is in Asia. So the action, the future, as is known, is in Asia. So I think Europe presents two problems. Their basket case economy, they're not growing. And the other thing is, I think that their governments are cracking down on free speech. You know, I think that liberalism, in the big L sense of the word, liberalism, I think they've really walked back from. So I do see this kind of cultural rupture that is happening with Europe. But, you know, look, you see Britain do this with Europe once every 25 years. You see France, you think Charles de Gaulle do it with Europe once. I mean, you know, we have spats. So, you know, that happens.
So you talked about the United States taking on China while Europe takes on Russia. Has that been stated anywhere? I mean, do you feel as though the UN or not the UN, the NATO, for instance, knows that's what America is up to? Or is that something that is kind of said between the lines?
I think it's said more than in between the lines. When you read people like the I'm not the biggest fan of Pete Hegseth. I'm just not, but I will tell you, there's some great hires at the Pentagon. One in particular is somebody named Elbridge Colby, who is the grandson of the former director, William Colby. And if you read his stuff, he's undersecretary of affairs at Pentagon. If you actually read some of his stuff, he's really foreshadowing. He had to get Senate approval. What he's been saying, and he and I, we've communicated on Twitter, I think he saw my China Taiwan promo in 2022 and started following me and said, basically, you're really, you have your finger on the pulse of something here. What our school of thinking is that America has to be realistic with its resource movements. So it's a long strain of belief that China is too big to handle that. And the other big long strain of belief is that NATO, our NATO partners, how could they really help us in a conflict like that? They don't really have the military capacity to really help us. They don't even have the military capacity to handle their own neighborhood. So I think that what Trump is saying to them is right. I think how he's saying it is abhorrent. This NATO concept of an attack on one is an attack on all. The idea is, okay, so let's say we got attacked. What would you guys even do to help us? Whereas Japan and, Australia, South Korea, I mean, that's in their self-interest right there. So you're starting to see kind of a, I don't want to say an Eastern NATO, because that's, but, in all but name, Japan gets attacked, we're attacked. If we're attacked, Japan's attacked. South Korea, same thing. You know, I mean, China tried to take over South Korea, you know, would try to help North Korea. So, you know, those, it seems like the action economically is moving to Asia. Military capacity is moving to Asia. And sadly, Europe is becoming a basket case, relative, very much like Greece did when Rome rose. Greece, this great culture of cradle of civilization, became kind of a basket case who just did what they were told. Now, is that the story? Is the story of Europe written? Is it finished? Absolutely not. You get the right set of leaders in there and they start actually focusing and pushing and doing what they need to do. You know, but if you get snapshot today, right now, that's how it looks.
So I want to go to China and Taiwan. You've spoken quite a bit about the U.S.-China tension. And, you know, I kind of want to know what you think is at stake. I mean, you almost seem to think it's inevitable at some point. And, you know, why is it inevitable? And what's at stake? What are we not thinking of? What's media not? I mean, some people say World War III's already started.
I wouldn't say World War III. That's dramatic.
Or we're at war with China already, or however you want to put it.
We're in a capital war with China right now.
Yeah,
I mean, so you look at the rise of gold. You look at the rise of gold. It coincides with the dropping of their treasury holdings. So they're getting this surplus every month from trade. What are they doing? The gold, they're not buying treasuries. That has gone down. The same time that has gone down, gold has gone up.
Yeah.
You know, period.
So how do you see things unfolding in the Taiwan area?
I don't ever try to predict the future. What I can tell you is the past gives us some indicators. So I'm a big fan of Thucydides, the ancient Greek historian. And, you know, he wrote this book called The Peloponnesian War about the war between Athens and Sparta. And out of that came this theory called the Thucydides trap, which states that a rising power will always challenge an established power. And that is always true. There's just one exception. But when you think of England trying to challenge France, when you think of Spain trying to challenge England and France, like throughout history, mm-hmm. The Mongols trying to take Japan, the Mongols trying to take China. They did take China. You know, there's always, it's like a lion pride. The young lion always wants to take over the pride, will always, it's the nature of the thing, will always go for the dominant male. And the reason is because the stronger you get, the more you realize I want to write the system, the rules to benefit me. Right now, post-World War II, the rules were written to benefit the United States and our allies. All of a sudden, if I'm becoming more powerful than you, I want the rules to benefit me. So that is the nature of things. There's only one exception to that in history. That exception is when we took the great power mantle over England after World War II. You know, and that is because we were working together and they were afraid of Russia, Soviet Union. So, you know, but England, they handed the great power mantle to us over the Suez Canal. Eisenhower threatened to bankrupt their country, basically. So basically the transition happened there. So China, history says, and nature says, that China will challenge us for supremacy. So the rules benefit them. Now, we're not going to hand it to you. You don't hand the crown to somebody. You got to take the crown. You know, how do you take the crown? You know, you can do it. You hope they do it through chess. If it is destiny for China to have the crown, you hope it's done through chess, where I could show you how I got you trapped without it becoming a hot war. You know, because a hot war would just be devastating. Now, you know, so look, Xi Jinping has said he wants his military to take China, be ready to take China by 2027. Those are his words, not mine. He has wrapped his authority and authenticity around reunifying with Taiwan, which is, you know, odd. They've never owned Taiwan. You know, the Chinese Communist Party, the government has never owned Taiwan. So, you know, but that's a matter of national pride. You can't really say that for 50 years and not follow through and have any, you know, kind of credibility. And I remember Henry Kissinger's book on China. And he said, you know, every time we went to meet with them, Nixon or, you know, Ford, whomever, anytime I was in government, we went to meet with them. We had demands. Well, we want to see South Korea do this. We want to see Japan do that. They always were like, China, Taiwan, China, Taiwan, you know, China, Taiwan. They have been obsessively focused on this for 50 plus years. So, you know, the problem is if they take Taiwan, Japan is right beneath that. That is a national security threat to Japan because they'll be able to outflank Japan and break out of what we call the first island chain. Now, Japan would, so if we don't defend Taiwan, what will happen is, well, first of all, they'll get all AI chips and semiconductor manufacturing, which is like modern day oil. I mean, it's more important than oil, you know, as important. But what happened is all of our allies, like little flowers, will tilt towards China and away from us if they get Taiwan. So, you know, it's in our self-interest. And imagine a world where our allies are all tilted that way. All capital will flow to China. You know, all tech will flow there. All investment will flow there. I mean, America would be 30, 40% poorer in 10 years if that happened.
I read Chip War and I learned about the advancement of the semiconductors in Taiwan. And you mentioned that we've essentially been in a currency war with them for quite some time and we're fighting for supremacy. I know that, you know, America knows, you know, thinks through what's at stake and if it's juice is worth the squeeze. And I guess the question I have is if China were to invade Taiwan, do you think America has the best, is it in their best interest to defend it? And how far do you think it'll go? Or can it go?
Well, first of all, it's a good question. If I were a military planner in Washington, I would be saying to China in private, you might be able to take Taiwan. American public might not, you know, because every war game scenario shows us losing 40,000 lives and them losing 100,000. You know, it's just a disaster. Believe me, the Taiwan you would get would not have any AI factories, any semiconductor factories. We would blow every single factory up. So you might be able to get Taiwan, but there will not be a goddamn factory in that country that's left standing. It'll all be ruin and rubble. So that's what I would be telegraphing. And we could take those factories out in minutes, basically. You know, just satellite directed, bang, 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 bang. Which is why we're trying to push Taiwan Semiconductor to bring their manufacturing capacity here. You know, matter of fact, a report came out today that they've been trying, Lutnick, has been trying to push them to move 40% of their productive capacity to America. Now, if you're Taiwan and Taiwan Semiconductor, you know the only thing that's kept you safe are these advanced semiconductors. They make 90% of advanced semiconductors. What brilliant people. I love them. Industrious, hardworking people. But that's the only thing that's kept you safe from China, that you make these things. You know, otherwise, nobody would really care. Knock yourself out. Japan would care, but that's another story. For our purposes, you can't let China have access to the 90% of the advanced chips that make our F-35s fly, our iPhones work. That's because what they can do is they will control the tap. What they would say is, okay, we're not giving you any of these semiconductors unless you agree to these terms. Some of the terms will be in public. You support our takeover. Some of the terms will be in private. You start trading in convertible currency, in non-convertible currencies, using our yuan as a currency over the dollar. So there'll be some in public. The ones you got to worry about are the ones they do in private.
Dylan, so just so you know, I've shared with you off the camera, but I'm a subscriber of your, you know, Behind the Markets and the several, I mean, all the programs you have. But I've benefited personally from investing in Palantir. When you called it around $7, I got in when I was 11. I think today I saw it was over 140. And I know you cover a wide range of companies and sectors, including, you know, precious metals. I know that you said you were in gold for quite a bit for a while. And I think what I recall, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I recall you having some sort of contingency sort of thing in case China does invade, like semiconductors, for instance. Like, is there like a black swan? Like, you can't predict black swans by definition, but are there like under the radar risk that you're taking into strong consideration that people aren't talking about, where you have, you know, if in case it happens event, you know, you've got a play, like a semiconductor play, or you got a gold play, or you got the next Palantir? Are there, what can you tell us about, you know, how you're positioning yourself or how people can, you know, think about things moving forward?
Well, I mean, you know, big, without getting specific, I can say a couple things. You know, when you know, let's say gold ETF are always good, and gold, in my view, should be 10% of a portfolio. You know, they should be 10% of your portfolio with the value of the dollar. I think a lot of people, they misunderstand that all these stocks are rising. Everything's rising at the same time. Stocks are rising at the same time. Bonds, real, you know, everything's rising at the same time. Gold, precious metals, silver, et cetera. That's not a good sign. That's exactly. Actually a sign that the measuring stick we use to measure them has shrunk. So that's a sign that the dollar is shrinking. They're rising in relation to the dollar. So that's a dangerous actual sign. I don't think people really understand that. I also don't think they really price the China risk, the China-Taiwan risk. You know, I think this, they just don't really. So, you know, I think a portfolio should have 10% of itself in gold. I think the US dollar is under threat. You know, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I think that story is not written, you know, what happens. But, you know, for those people that are interested in diversifying, there are some gold ETFs, you know, a good gold ETF. You know, I know that's not what your members want to hear or your viewers want to hear. But the key is that 10% of your portfolio should probably be in, you know, gold or something like that, just a hedge, as a dollar hedge, as a measuring stick hedge, you know. The other thing I think is, but you have to remember something, you know, when you buy a gold ETF, you don't really have you have a paper claim. It's like a tracking thing, really. It's not really a claim on the gold itself. So I like big gold miners, generally speaking. I think they're, you know, in a world where there's an economic calamity, you know, you want a business that has less exposure to China and in that area, their mines are not, let's say, in Australia. You want something away from that. You want something here, because there's an economic calamity, Steve. I mean, market drops about 48% start of a major power war. You know, if you look at World War One, World War Two. So, you know, basically it'd be a massive drop and, you know, gold would spike, bond yields would, you know, well, actually there'd probably be a massive intervention. But, you know, markets drop about 50%, you know, within the months of a war starting like that. So this would be a great destroyer of capital. And the one thing that I always remember when you look at history, the things that do well in the short term are gold, because people flight, they run to safety. In the long term, they are companies historically that have strong reputations with consumer, little debt, strong balance sheets, and they have pricing power. They can actually raise their prices above the inflation rate. And I'll just give you a quick example, then I'll stop. You think of Hershey. You know, Hershey, big deal, right? Boring as hell. But Hershey, if inflation comes in at 3%, what's unique about Hershey, inflation comes in at 3%. Most companies have to eat that, or they can only raise their price by 1%. They don't have pricing power. Hershey's can raise their prices 5 cents, 5%. So for every dollar, inflation comes in at 3%. That means their input costs go up. Hershey's can raise their by 5 cents, 5 cents per dollar, 5%. They can actually capture extra margin. You know, so they're actually raising prices ahead of their input costs. So if you actually look at history, it's companies that have pricing power, strong brand names and pricing power, those will be steals in a black swan event type of scenario. Just absolute steals. Steals. Consumer products, strong brand name, good balance sheet, raising pricing power, able to raise prices above inflation. Because again, in a black swan event like that, there would be hoarding. There would be all types of things that happen. Remember, you know, 40% of trade goes right through the South China Sea. So immediately, everything, the couches, you know, you look at the glasses container, the chair I'm sitting in, this case, it's all made over there. That would be frozen. Black Market City.
So one of the things that got me into Palantir, well, the main thing I've got you to think, again, calling it $7 when now it's $140, but Palantir, I invested because it's a AI, you know, technology company, but I invested in it because you convinced me about its military importance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've invested in Leidos as well, but you know, you mentioned having a hedge, you mentioned, you know, gold value, you mentioned the ETF and having 10%, but like what sectors do you like right now? And then if you can tell us about Behind the Markets a little bit, what that's all about and how people can find you and benefit.
Well, I'll tell you, defense. So, you know, we, a lot of people talk about, so AI sector, obviously, but a lot, the question is, how do you use AI? What's happening now in defense is unbelievable. You know, we have Jim Mattis to thank for that, the former Treasury Secretary, former Defense Secretary. So throughout the history of mankind, the key for defense, and this is what makes Palantir so special, and a couple of other names I'll give you in a minute, is the kill chain. What is a kill chain? The kill chain is the process by which we identify, target, and kill the opponent. You think of Alexander the Great or the Mongols, they see somebody across the field, they identify, they target, they lift up their arrows, they shoot their bow, and boom. And that's a kill chain. That was a kill chain back in those days. Kill chain during World War One was, I see the guy across the field and I take my machine gun and I start to, I'm able to speed up the kill chain, kill more people faster, right? Still identifying them across the field, but targeting and killing them faster. Well, now, for the first time in human history, we're removing humans from the kill chain and they're being replaced by robots, by AI, by Palantir. So basically, and again, you think of the South China Sea, you think of a, think about, they go in on Taiwan, we move our ships over there. Before, you'd have a Navy gunner sitting on the deck, China would fly in and the guy would be going bang, 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 bang at the incoming. There's no human that can fight 10,000 drones. So these guns are all going to be determined and controlled by systems like Palantir, where these weapons will automatically identify incoming, target them, and kill them. There's no human, because if you're China, you send in 20,000 drones, because you know half of them will get in, hit the ships, and sink them, and then that ship is gone, right? So laser weapons, Lockheed Martin makes some great laser weapons. Elbit Systems makes great laser weapons, ESLT. You know, again, think of that, because you have the problem of identifying, targeting, and killing. The other problem is ammunition. The ship can't, how do you reinforce that ship's ammunition? So they're moving to laser weapons, which are like nuclear power, doesn't really run out. So it's cheaper and you don't run out of ammo. So we're really moving towards AI weapons and laser, you know, a non-kinetic, you know, artillery, basically laser. That's, you know, Elbit Systems is great in that area. You know, they're an Israeli company, killing it. The other thing is AVAV, AeroVironment. Again, you know, great drone company. You know, again, this is drone warfare. We're moving into an era where drones, I think everybody knows that by now. And Kratos, KTOS, these are all companies that I've been following for a while in the defense sector, and that I think are just really great. Smart management teams. These guys understand where the ball is.
Dylan, you also recommended gold plays. Do you have any gold in your portfolio now? And if you can just tell us about Behind the Markets and how people can find you and what that's all about.
So I just have gold ETFs in my portfolio right now. But in terms of Behind the Markets, we went long gold in 2022. The minute Joe Biden froze Russian assets when they invaded Ukraine, I viewed that as a, you know, a really dangerous thing to do, actually, because what you basically telegraph to every other country in the world is that if you hold U.S. Treasury bonds or anything in U.S., if you make a move that you believe is in your national security interest, we will actually freeze your dollars. So that just is crazy. China jumped on that and said, you can't trust them. Let's go to gold, yada, yada. The rest is history. So you know, for the average person, you are an expert on gold and gold stock. So I would be talking to you about that. I'm going to be picking your brain about that in private. You know, that's for sure. But, for the person that doesn't even want to bother with this, you know, ETFs is what I recommend if you don't want to bother with it. But if you want an expert opinion, I'd go to you. So in terms of behind the markets, you know, we publish independent research for independent investors, people who understand quality, people who care about quality. You know, we've been doing this for 8 years. We have a 74% win rate, 42% average gain on every trade, closed trades. So, you know, I mean, I've been doing this for 35 years. We started this business in 2018, and our track record is, you know, compiled and audited by a professional guy who does that. And look, 75, we're almost right 75% of the time with a 40% average gain. I mean, you know, come on. You know, for people who like quality, that's what we do.
Just for our listeners, I personally am a subscriber and investor in Behind the Markets, but Behind the Markets is not paying for this, is not sponsoring this interview. I'm not giving investment advice. Please stay smart, do your own research, and consult with Dylan and other people with strong track records. I'm just Steve Yang, learning alongside you from people smarter than me. Stay smart, everyone. Stay curious. Stay disciplined. Dylan, thanks again for being here.
Thank you for having me, Steve.